Tonight we're looking at a passage that has had a great deal of controversy, and that is 1 Corinthians 11. And when we consider a passage such as this, we need to have a charitable attitude toward other people. Hopefully each of us knows more now than we did 10 years ago, and so we should be willing to give charity toward other people just like we would have liked to have received 10 years ago. This passage, I believe, is largely despised by modern evangelicals. It's usually ignored or explained away. And we need to approach the text as a learner, not as an instructor instructing the text. There may be some things that are hard to understand and that we don't really know the full meaning. But what our job is to understand as much as we can and obey what we understand. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning with verse 2. Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head. But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. For that is one and the same as if her head were shaved. For if a woman is not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it is shameful for a woman to be shorn or shaved, let her be covered. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. For man is not from woman, but woman from man. Nor was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. For this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, neither is man independent of woman, nor woman independent of man in the Lord. For as woman came from man, so man also comes through woman, but all things are from God. Judge among yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. But if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. Notice in verse 2, he begins with an affirmation of their obedience to his teaching in all things. And it's important to notice that these are not just arbitrary practices, what we often call traditions in our way of speaking. They cannot be added or dropped at will. Paul is talking about things he expects Christians to faithfully observe. 2 Thessalonians 2:15 says, stand firm and hold to the traditions, whether by word or our epistle. So there he's speaking of authority regarding the traditions. Separate yourself from a brother who does not live according to the traditions received from Paul. You can read that in 2 Thessalonians 3:6. And then 1 Corinthians 14:37, Paul says, he who is spiritual, let him acknowledge that the things that I write are the commandments of God. Verse 3 is the foundation of this whole discussion, the divine and human headship. And it shows what an important issue this whole thing is. In other words, the fact that he begins to speak about the order of things in the Godhead, and then from God to humanity, and then man to woman, shows this is not a minor issue. It is connected with the proper attitude about God. Now, it's impossible to have a right attitude toward a superior and to deliberately insult them at the same time. Imagine if you had filthy work clothes on and you just changed the transmission fluid in your van, and then you had to do something quick and run through this certain place and got your shoes all full of clay mud, and then you just go right from there to a White House dinner with the president. And without changing your clothes, without getting washed up, and you just say, well, after all, the president should know that I have a good attitude toward him and that I appreciate him a great deal. That kind of action would exhibit a wrong attitude. I believe this is one of the reasons, since this is such a foundational issue, this is one of the reasons why when people get serious about following God and come to this passage, they think, well, we ought to be doing this. So, notice that this divine and human headship is not demeaning. It is connected with the intrinsic nature of things. Christ is not less God. Woman is not less human. Verse 3, it explicitly says every man, but does not explicitly say every woman. Thus, every man has Christ as authority, whether he's a Christian or whether he isn't. And woman, whether married or not, is subordinate to man. In other words, the focus of these passages is not particularly husband and wife. The focus is the creation order, the headship order, the relationship of woman to man. It is not a woman to her husband specifically in this passage. Verses 4 to 6, you have the fact that the improper covering dishonors your superior. Notice again, it is explicit every man and every woman in verse 4 and 5, and that's a contrast to verse 3. So these specifications are applicable to every man and every woman, not just for married women. Now, you make that point because sometimes people go off on a tangent and they say, well, if a woman isn't married, then why should she wear a veiling? They've just come along and assumed this is talking about husband and wife. It's not talking about husband and wife in particular. It's talking about the relationship of man and woman. So what are some of the things that we need to look at in this passage? One is we need to understand a little bit about prophecy. You know, prophecy in the Bible is used various ways. For example, future events, the book of this prophecy, it's talking about something that's going to happen in the future, or revelatory episodes, like the soldiers said to Jesus when he was blindfolded, prophesy, who struck you? Or, you know, there in 1 Corinthians 14, it's talking about speaking done in order so that all may learn and all may be encouraged. It was prophecy that was going on there. And man, in this passage, is the Greek word aner, and that is a contrast to the Greek word anthropos, which can refer to man or mankind. Aner always means man as distinct from woman or husband. For example, 1 Timothy 2:4, where it says God desires all men to be saved, doesn't he care about the women? Well, the answer is the word is anthropos. In other words, that means he desires everyone to be saved, all of mankind to be saved. So this word that's used here in this passage, though, refers only to a man or a husband, cannot refer to a woman. And then kephale, the word for head, it's used throughout as the only word for head. And there are two heads in this passage. One is the physical head. That's the part that's to be covered or uncovered. In all of these cases where you're talking about the physical head, they appear without the possessive pronoun associated with it, his or her. And then the head that's dishonored, that's the metaphorical head, that always occurs with the possessive pronoun his or her. And the head that's dishonored is the superior. Now, let me comment here that these pronoun distinctions are clear in Greek, but they may be obscured by some of your passages in the translation. So don't just go looking at the passage in English and then say, oh, didn't happen here. You can check it out when you read the Greek. Verse 4, he talks about the covered man. He deals with the man first, and he says that praying or prophesying while covered dishonors Christ. And then verse 5 and 6, he talks about the uncovered woman. Praying or prophesying uncovered dishonors her authority. And the reason, verse 5, is that it's the same as if she was shaved. Now remember, in verse 15, long hair is given as a special glory for the woman, given to her by God. And praying uncovered, then, is just as arrogant as against God's design as if she disdained her special glory by shaving it off. And also, verse 7, it's an arrogant thing against the man because she is to be his glory. Now, the analogy is, verse 6, an uncovered woman is as shameful as a shaved or a shorn woman. And the word shorn is the Greek word kero, and that word is used for shearing sheep. And thus it describes a close cut. It's not talking about, you know, having shoulder-length hair with the ends cut off. That's not what it means by shorn. You're talking about cutting it close. There are lots of references of this in the Old Testament, in the Greek translation. The Greek translation of the Old Testament is helpful sometimes to help you understand what a certain Greek word means, because you see how it was used and you can compare it with Hebrew or with English. Anyway, there are lots of references in the Old Testament using this word. Laban, for example, Genesis 31:19, and Christ, Isaiah 53:7. In the New Testament, Paul had his head shorn, Acts 18:18. So the usages that it's focused on here are not, you know, cutting some off and leaving 6, 8, or 10 inches in place. Now this shows that God's way of looking at things is different than man's way of looking at things. If shaven is shameful, and I think practically everyone agrees that if a woman's head is shaved, that would be shameful. Most people agree that being sheared like a sheep would be shameful. Now, I was in New York City one time, and a woman was walking up the street ahead of me, and her hair was cut all over about an eighth of an inch long, and it was covered with sparklies. I assume she thought that was very beautiful. So, you know, as society departs from reality, they're going to have aberrant things going on. But I think in general, people would recognize that a woman shaved would be shorn-ful. But if you noticed, in our day, you often see women with very, very short hair. Anyway, if it is shameful, common sense argument. If it's shameful, let her be covered. Now, do you get this? It's like an uncovered woman is as shameful as a shaved head. And so, if it's that shameful, then be covered. The logic of the argument is like this. If a woman begins to act like a man, being uncovered, she should follow the logical conclusion and have her hair cut short like a sheep or shaven, and then she'll see how shameful it is. We don't tend to think about this very deeply. We tend to think, well, what if she isn't covered? It doesn't seem like such a big deal. And Paul is saying something in contrast to how we think. He's saying, let her be shorn or shaven then, if she hadn't covered. And our tendency to think is, oh, well, that would be awful. Right. Glad you got the point. It's terrible to be uncovered. Verses 7 to 12. A proper covering is founded in creation. Now, verse 7, the focus of this argument is stronger than the common sense argument in verse 6. The rationale here comes from the created order of things. In the preceding verse, a woman shouldn't act like a man, and here it's a man shouldn't act like a woman. Now, verse 7, you have the glory issue. Notice that man is created as the image and glory of God. Remember in Genesis 1:27, both man and woman were created in the image of God. But then here, Paul adds the word glory regarding man, but not woman. In other words, mankind was the crowning act of creation, the image of God. And notice God created mankind in stages. Adam was created out of dust, and then out of Adam, he formed Eve. Now, think about woman. In all of creation, woman was made in a unique way that surpasses the way man was made. I mean, man was just made out of dirt. And woman was made of something on a higher level. You know, when you start with a rib and flesh around that, you start with something much higher than just a piece of dirt. So you ladies, just remember that sometime. Might come in handy. Now, remember that woman is the glory of man, but not the image of man. A little thought will help you see that. The woman is complementary to man. The argument here is based not on the relationship of the first pair, that is, Adam's relationship to Eve as a pair, but it's the creation episode giving us to understand the relationship of man and woman. So what's the object lesson? The object lesson of the veiling for women and absence of veiling for the man is God's glory, man, is to be displayed, not covered. And man's glory, woman, is to be covered. So therefore, the appearance of men and women is to be a continual object lesson, how that we are reminded of the created order and God's headship order. That goes back to verse 3. But it's also a lesson in exalting God and living in humility before Him. It's not just man's authority over woman, but it's the total arrangement. And, you know, all of us need reminder of displaying God's glory and covering man's glory. Verses 8 and 9, you have woman's subordination emphasized by God's action in creation. Woman was formed from man, verse 8, and created for the man, verse 9. And then in verse 10, you have the angelic issue. He says, for this cause. Well, since the woman is formed from the man and for the man, and based on the created order, I think it's interesting that it's not here particularly whether she's praying or prophesying right at this point, but this is how she is to be, and therefore would include also times of prayer or prophecy. She is to have authority on her head. Now, sometimes people wonder about this, but it's crystal clear that a piece of cloth is not authority. No piece of cloth is authority. A piece of cloth may represent authority. Just like a badge on a policeman's chest is not authority. It represents authority. It's a symbol of authority. If somebody comes and opens their wallet and it says FBI, you know you have difficulties. See? This is the FBI. What does that mean? There's a big organization that thinks you're a criminal. We hope they're wrong. You can compare some usages. For example, the crowns on the heads of the dragon in Revelation 12. Those crowns on the heads are symbols of authority. Now, there have been various suggestions on what these angels are. And what does that mean? She ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Some people say, well, it must be bad angels. Angels cannot see the heart. God can, somebody said. You know, those kind of things don't really help too much because it seems like a man ought to have a symbol of authority on his head then too, shouldn't it? I think that it's possible that the angels in view here would be bad angels. And there are various testimonies of people who say when they were wearing a veiling, there seemed to be some protection in relation to the avoidance of evil events. But I think it could also relate to good angels. I mean, connect this with the fact that women are in general more open to deception than men, and the importance of trying the spirits to discern between good and bad spirits. So, rather than speculate with fancy-sounding words on what this means, I think it's better just to say because of the angels. If you have further enlightenment on there, I'll be glad to hear it. Verses 11 and 12, you have interdependence issues. Neither one can claim independence from the other. You know, so often a man wants to be off doing his thing, and people say stuff like this. Well, that's man's stuff, and this is woman's stuff. Well, verse 12, the interdependence is, the proof is that a woman was formed from the man, and yet men come from a human mother. Again, the focus on these things is not so much husband and wife, but the relationship of man and woman. You can see that flowing through the passage over and over again. Verse 12, God has designed this interdependence. All things are from God. God appointed it this way so we should accept it and not complain. Have you ever noticed that whenever men and women operate in isolation from each other, both sides are impoverished? These men that go off in some monastery somewhere and never see a woman for years and years, there's something really strange about that bunch as time goes on. It was probably strange to start with. They even wanted to do a thing like that. And the same thing with women going off into convents and that type of thing. Let's see some examples. You know, I think in general, women tend to be more emotional in their thinking than logical. I'm not saying totally. I know some women that are very logical. But as a general pattern, women tend to be more emotional than logical, and they need to learn logical thinking by having their husbands help them, or men in the church, or even in sessions like this. You can learn something about logical thinking. On the other hand, in general, it's probably true that men need to learn graciousness and gentleness from women. You see what I'm saying? Works both ways. In fact, a woman's sensitivity can steer her husband away from lots of unnecessary social pitfalls if he'll just listen. So, men and women tend to have certain strengths and certain weaknesses. And we shouldn't say, well, that's just the way a woman thinks. You know what? That is a degrading comment. Or how about this? Well, that's just the way a man is. You know what? Both of those statements are foolish. Instead, we ought to be saying something like this. I'm going to benefit from these other people created in the image of God, and which will help me be more like what God wants me to be. This interdependence is especially characteristic of those who are in the Lord, verse 11. Living in the sphere of the glorified Christ and benefiting from Him. Now, verses 13 to 15, he is saying that the propriety of a proper covering is obvious. Verse 13, it's improper for a woman to pray to God uncovered. And what he gives here is what's called a rhetorical question. A rhetorical question is a question done for oratory effect, and it's a question that the answer is totally obvious. So, it's totally obvious, he's saying. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? And the answer is no. It's obvious. Now, Paul, inspired by the Holy Spirit, thought it was obvious. So we should accept it even if it isn't obvious to us. See, sometimes people approach this saying, well, this is not obvious. Well, too bad for you. If Paul is saying it is obvious, then you ought to realign your thinking. Verse 14, nature teaches long hair is shameful for men, long hair a glory for women. Now that has hardly the thing of how long it grows. I remember when I was a boy, people would say, well, if a man grew his hair as long as he could, it wouldn't grow as long as a woman's. Oh, is that so? Did they ever see any pictures of American Indians and the long hair that those men had? And besides, in recent years, you've had a lot of exposure to hippies who've grown very long hair. So that'll hardly do it. And there are some women who cannot grow hair much longer than their shoulder, below their shoulders. So it's not that men can't grow long hair and that women always grow long hair. So what are the possibilities? Well, in general, women's hair grows longer and thicker than men's. And certainly it's very uncommon for a woman to be going bald on top. So one thing is clear, though. When you look at society and cultures and history, you find there is a strong general pattern over the world during eras, different eras of history. Women have hair much longer than men. In other words, there's a general consensus of humanity that a woman has longer hair, men have shorter hair. Again, this is a rhetorical question. It's supposed to be obvious from nature. So if it isn't obvious to us, then accept it and begin to make it obvious to yourself by just saying, well, God sees some things that I don't see. So he said it was obvious, so I believe it's obvious. Now, there are times that a society departs from things that are obvious to such an extent that God's precepts aren't obvious anymore. I think one of the areas that that has occurred is in this whole subject of marriage and divorce that we've been looking at. There's been such a departure, and then before long, the plain statements of Scripture aren't obvious anymore because things have been so twisted and perverted. And also, you may remember when you discuss an issue like fornication, that in many pagan cultures, it's not viewed as something that bad, it's just a normal part of life. So you see, that society is not viewing that as being that bad. That's what's happening in our culture, is it not? It just seems like a natural expression of life. But if you begin to let God take over your life and God's message to permeate your life, it becomes very obvious that fornication is not acceptable to God. Now, if people merely argue about what is obvious in our culture, we reply that evidently God thinks it should be obvious, and so we need to be thinking spiritually. And I think it's interesting that God views these things as so obvious that the questions are rhetorical. In other words, if you considered it at face value, it would be a silly question. Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is dishonor to him? If that wasn't a rhetorical question, what would be the point of a question? So, you see, that shows how obvious it is to be. And then verse 15, God gave woman long hair for a covering. Now, it's clear that God is talking about a covering for the head, not the face. Because he gave her hair on the head, not on the face. The idea that the hair is given her as a covering, God has instituted it for that. You know, a man might grow long hair, it's true, he might, but God instituted long hair for a covering for the woman, not the man. The Greek word there is parabolion, and there's another usage in the New Testament where it says the heavens will be folded up like a cloak, Hebrews 1:12. Now, sometimes people say, well, that means cast around like a cloak. So maybe you should have your hair just, they might think, well, maybe you should have your hair just cascaded around your shoulders. However, the focus of this passage is not the shoulders. What is it? The head. And so the hair is to be given a covering for the head. So I think actually the traditional thing of putting hair up is probably quite good. And then this is to be a universal practice. Sometimes people have approached this last verse as if Paul is saying, look, if you don't like this and you have a controversy, just forget it. Well, that would be such a silly thing to do, to spend all this time talking about the Godhead and the angels and the creation and all these things in relation to the veiling and then say, well, don't bother with it. I think it's much better to just say that this is the practice of the churches of God. And notice, it is transcultural. That is so important. People come to this passage, and again, they'll say, well, now, back in Paul's day, the harlots at Corinth cut their hair and didn't wear anything on their heads. And so Paul didn't want these people to be in the churches to be confused and people thinking they're harlots. So he said, have long hair, cover your heads. You know what the problem with that is? Paul doesn't say a word about Corinthian harlots. Not a word. That is all eisegesis. That means reading it into the text. You want to have exegesis, reading it out of the text. And so, this whole thing, this whole passage, the focus of it, Paul gives reasons that are transcultural. The reason about the Godhead, the order of creation, the divinely instituted relationship of man and woman, the angels, the natural propriety. All those things are tied up with transcultural things. And so, that helps us understand that this passage is to be applied somehow today, not just back there in Corinth's day. Now, I want to mention a few things about the veiling as it's practiced in history and culture. In the ancient practice, you have Sarah, how her beauty was seen. And Rebecca had an unveiled face at the well, Genesis 24:16. And her obvious beauty prompted an outright lie, Genesis 26:7. And you remember, Abraham was afraid that people would see his beautiful wife. Do you think that she was covered up with a burqa type thing? I don't think so. So what I'm pointing out is these veils that they wore weren't just totally covering the face, or at least if they wore that on certain occasions, they certainly didn't wear that all the time. I'm mentioning that because maybe I should mention also Tamar, who played the harlot. She veiled herself to hide her identity, and that implied that she was recognized by sight ordinarily. And so I want to just help us see that we don't have to feel like a woman needs to appear with face covered in public like a Muslim does. What was the early church like? Well, Paul's letter would suggest that the veiling was common practice among Christians, verse 16. And then around someone who lived around 150, Tertullian, wrote a article called De Corona, which referred to a strong tradition of practice. And he also wrote an article called On the Veiling of Virgins. And he was trying to refute the notion that the veiling applied only to married women. Now, I think that's pretty interesting because you see way back there, around 150 A.D. or so, you're having the same kind of controversies and the same kind of questions that people talk about today. He said that a majority of Greek churches keep virgins covered, also some in Africa. Clement of Alexandria also wrote, Augustine, who would have been living around 400 A.D., allowed costly ornamentation but required a veiling. And in the catacomb art, you see something called a palla, which is a scarf on the head hanging down to the shoulders. So you can see here that they faced the same kind of issues, and also there was resistance in their day. There were people that didn't want to do it. It wasn't universally accepted, and so there was need for teaching and exhortation. Things aren't new, are they? Later history, there's rare references to the veiling in the Middle Ages. Not much of an issue with the Reformers, even though Calvin's commentary on Corinthians suggests there was some issue. And there are very few evidences, or references rather, to the veiling in Anabaptist thought before 1865. If you look at the art of a couple hundred years ago, it is customary to see women in the West wearing something on their head. There's no uniform standard. And a cap was widely worn in America. You can just go back and look at the original art. Now, if you're looking at some history book that came out in recent years, you might not see it. But if you look at art that was painted back in the period, you'll see that. So you can see how the veiling became the norm. But then, in modern times, it gradually discontinued. And so in the latter 19th century, Mennonites began to speak up about it. In fact, long hair and the veiling was a particular concern to Mennonites after World War I. I have a quotation here from Encyclopedia Americana, and I want to read it because, you know, this is not a religious encyclopedia. This is what a secular encyclopedia says. Quote, "As a result of World War I, women everywhere cut or bobbed their hair as a symbol of their political and social emancipation." End of quote. That's what a secular author had to say who's writing about what happened. There's been widespread breakdown in this. I went to Goshen College and looked in their library, and I looked at the college yearbooks to see the pictures of the people. But I also looked in the handbook to see if the college required veilings, because I wanted to see if this reflected the constituency or if it reflected just the policy of the school. And the veiling was not required by the handbooks, so that would show you what the constituency was doing. In 1905, there was long hair often, only occasional veils. 1915, long hair common, veils uncommon. 1925, both were common. 1935, some long hair and coverings. 1945, both long hair and coverings, common among students, but not universal, and there's no faculty that is definitely unveiled. The reason I word it that way, sometimes just the way a picture is taken, you can't absolutely tell whether a person has a veiling on or not. And then, in 1955, both are common among students and faculty, but not universal. And in 1965, very few veilings on students, none on the faculty. Many faculty had short hair, and most students had short hair. And then 75 and 85, no veiling seen, and cut hair was the norm. Did you notice there is a sudden shift when you move from 1955 to 1965? Why has this breakdown occurred? I believe that fundamentally, it's because people hate this passage. I think it's illustrated by the alternate translation that is given by the NIV. I want you to look at verses 4 through 6 in your Bible. And what the NIV does is correctly translate it in the text. But then it puts a footnote and then says, or, as if here's an alternate way. Now listen to the alternate they give while you look at what you've got. Every man who prays or prophesies with long hair dishonors his head. That's no problem. And every woman who prays or prophesies with no covering of hair on her head dishonors her head. She is just like one of the shorn women. If a woman has no covering, let her be for now with short hair. But since it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair shorn or shaved, she should grow it again. A man ought not to have long hair. That is just pure nonsense. There isn't a Greek text in existence that says any such thing. Why did those men put that there? Because they knew what the text says and they hated it. I actually talked to one of the men who was on the translation committee. And he said, well, he agreed with me. There was no Greek text that gave any support for what they did there. But he hadn't helped translate that part. Oh, I should have asked him, did you raise an objection? You should have. So how do we apply this? I believe it should be applied today. I believe that additional covering besides the long hair is required. In other words, long hair is not sufficient. I think it should be worn continually, not just once in a while. And, of course, people are going to object to this, so that's deal with objections. When someone heard that I was going to be speaking on this subject in another place, they said to me, well, I believe the point of the passage is spiritual, not physical. But I don't make an issue of it. Now, what's wrong with that statement? The thing that's wrong with the statement is it contradicts the passage. Obviously, Paul in his writings is concerned about the spiritual. And undoubtedly, he is concerned about spiritual issues here. People should have the right attitude when they're praying or prophesying. People should have right relationships with fellow believers. People should be living in a way that's appropriate regarding the angelic hosts. But this is obviously not the focus of the passage. What's the focus of the passage? The focus of the passage is the importance in God's program of wearing this piece of cloth or not wearing this piece of cloth to be in a proper relationship with the divine order of things. That's the point. You know, this is just the kind of arguments that people make up that are so damaging because someone hears that and they think, oh, yes, that sounds spiritual. It's not spiritual. Galatians chapter 2. Peter could have said, well, the fact that I don't physically eat with a few Gentiles isn't the real issue. You know what Paul did? Paul confronted him with the wrong attitude and also with the physical thing of not eating with the Gentiles. I mean, it wouldn't have been sufficient for Peter to simply deal with his attitude toward the Gentiles and then still eat just with the Jews. That wouldn't have been sufficient. It's not an either or. See, some people say things like, well, you could wear the veiling and still be in bad shape. Well, that's true. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't do what God says. Peter could have eaten with the Gentiles and the Jews and still been in bad shape, right? And the fact that he ate just with the Jews showed he had a heart problem that needed to be dealt with, and Paul dealt with it. You see, when the heart is fixed, then this other physical thing is fixed also. Furthermore, you could argue that other things are totally unnecessary to observe. In terms of like the ordinances. Baptism. Because aren't the primary issues there spiritual? I mean, after all, is God's primary concern that we get all wet? No. His primary concern is you're departing from your old life and you're walking in a new life. And this is a graphic reminder of the whole thing. Well, then why do we bother to get wet? Anybody know? Because God said so. What about the Lord's Supper? Is God's primary interest that we occasionally eat unleavened bread and drink some grape juice? I understand grape juice is really good for you. So, I'm glad to drink some grape juice. I want to have my brain improved and all the other things it's supposed to do for you. That's fine with me. But if that's the primary thing, let's drink a gallon of it. I mean, God is more concerned about what? Remembering Christ's death, His great sacrifice, our unworthiness, our great need, all those things. He's more concerned about that than the grape juice and the bread, right? Does that mean we skip the grape juice and bread? No. Now, you would think that something as important as Christ's death, we wouldn't need a physical reminder in order to keep it in our minds. I mean, that's so central to the whole gospel story, you'd think that wouldn't have to have some little ritual. Guess what? God evidently saw that we needed that thing. You know what? That relates exactly to this whole veiling issue. This whole thing with women's role and man's role without the veiling. It gets really confused fast. Now, there are plenty of women who have a veiling on and they're living in a very wicked and ungodly way, bossing their husbands and manipulating them and badgering the church and just being a big problem. That's sinful. But in general, when you have churches that practice the woman wearing a veiling, you do not have nearly the cases of women out of their place in terms of general function. In general, you have a focus more on the home and on the children and all of that. When once you take away the veiling, you find out that then women move in other kinds of directions. Verse 16, here's another objection. Verse 15. According to verse 15, the hair is the covering. So you don't need any more. First of all, in verse 15, you have a different word. The Greek word is parabolion. Now, just because there's a different word doesn't prove in itself you're talking about two different things. Because we use synonyms. We use two different words for a variety or for various effects, and we're talking about the same thing. But the burden of proof is on the person who claims they're the same. You have to prove that these two are the same. I mean, it's a first-line indicator that maybe they aren't the same. So unless they can be proven the same, you should be taking them as different. So let's try out their arguments. Suppose we say the covering is the hair. Then go to verse 6. If a woman is not covered, that means her hair was cut off like a sheep, let her also be shorn. Oops, it's already off. You see, it makes nonsense out of verse 6. It also makes nonsense out of verses 4 and 7. I mean, men should shave or go bald in order to honor God. So some of us are proceeding faster than others. Now, what often happens when you show somebody the folly of their arguments, then instead of saying, I was wrong, and changing their view, they just modify their argument slightly so that they can keep their position and not be affected by your arguments. Can you guess what they change it to then? Oh, well, it's not the hair that's the covering. It's the long hair that's the covering. Now, if you take that view, then what happens is you'll have a conflict with the prohibition of the man not being covered. I mean, verse 4 becomes very unnatural in its interpretation. You see, if in verse 4 covering means long hair, then you would expect this terminology as in verse 14. Why do you say covering? Why do you say, in other words, in verse 4, it says covering. Why don't you just go ahead and say long hair? And it also forces verse 5 into a strange statement. Hair not long is the same as if shaved. See, if long hair is the covering, then hair not long is the same as shaved. Well, that's obviously false, unless you are speaking in some metaphorical sense. And even so, it is clearly shameful. Furthermore, it avoids the natural reading of the passage. And it demands four kinds of hair to work. The passage speaks of three: long, shorn, and shaven. And now, to make this long hair argument work, you've got to have another one called medium. So what are you doing? Eisegesis, reading into the text again. Remember this. People think, well, this is a possible interpretation. You know, just because something is a possible interpretation doesn't even in remotest possibility mean that it's the right one. I mean, what if I said regarding the pastor? Today, I heard him with my ears tell his wife, "I'm leaving." Oh, imagine what that is. What is a possible interpretation of that? He's leaving his wife and not coming back. Now, when you know everything about the situation, is that a possible interpretation? When you know all the context and all the life that goes behind it, and all the relationship that goes behind it, is that a possible interpretation? Not a chance. See, just because something is theoretically possible doesn't mean it's correct at all. And so many people approach a verse and they think, well, you could say it means this, and you could say it means this, and if you just had those two, if you just had one verse and nothing else in the whole Bible, then that'd be a possibility. But since you know a whole lot more than that, you know about the paragraph, the chapter, the book, the New Testament, the Old Testament, you know, study the paragraph, that'll eliminate one of these false interpretations. Study the chapter, that'll eliminate another. Study the book, that'll eliminate another. Study the New Testament, eliminates another. Study the Old Testament, eliminates another. I mean, you can have four or five wrong interpretations, and you can get to the right one. See, I don't believe there are five different interpretations of things. Scripture is of no private interpretation. You know, we can't just pick whatever view we want. That's one of the big dangers of the Strong's Concordance. People look up a word and they look in there and they just look at all those words and they just say, oh, I like that one, that's the one I'm going to use. That is not the way to use it. You know what? You'd be better off not even looking in there and just read the text that somebody who knew how to translate had already translated. Because the context is going to tell you more than what just looking back there at that list of words that are used is going to tell you. After all, if long hair is the covering, then why would Paul write anything about a veiling? If long hair is the covering. John Calvin, in his commentary on 1 Corinthians, wrote a rebuttal centuries ago. Quote, should anyone now object that her hair is enough as being a natural covering, Paul says it is not. For it is such a covering as requires another thing to be made use of for covering it. End of quote. Do you think about it? Same controversy must have been going on because somebody must have been saying, oh, well, the hair, that's good enough. Another objection people make is the veiling is only for worship in the assembly since it's in a section dealing with church doctrine. Now, in actuality, the assembly is not in view until verse 17. This is an example of circular reasoning. They'll say, well, the first chapters are talking about one thing, and then chapter 11 and following is talking about the assembly. Now, since it's talking about the assembly, this must mean that the veiling is just for in the public assembly. That is just circular reasoning. They just arbitrarily chopped it into those blocks, and the fact of the matter is, the assembly isn't in view until verse 17. Verse 17, you come together. Verse 18, you come together in assembly. Verse 20, when you come together. And therefore, verses 2 to 16 cannot be limited just to church meetings. You can just as easily connect the first half of 1 Corinthians with the first 10 chapters as with what follows. Someone might say, well, but the headship veiling material is foundation for the chapters that follow. Well, fine. But that doesn't limit the application to the assembly. In other words, it applies to whenever a woman prays or prophesies. Now, you understand what circular reasoning is. You assume this certain thing, and then on the basis of that thing you just assumed, you prove this thing that you wanted to prove. In fact, the Amplified Bible actually inserts into the text words to convey the idea of public ministry. For example, verse 5, any woman who publicly, and they put that in brackets, prays. And verse 7, for a man ought not to wear anything on his head, bracket, in church. You see, if you limit this to the assembly, it does not deal adequately with verse 13, where it says that it's improper for a woman to pray to God uncovered. And again, this is rhetorical. It is not merely just a question in light of this weighty material that was taught. Furthermore, the continuity of the glory of God displayed and the glory of man covered fits in with having a continual wearing rather than just in the assembly. So, anyway, use their argument. Just assume that it applies only to the corporate assembly. Then it produces a conflict with 1 Corinthians 14 and 1 Timothy 2, 9-15, which says women are to be silent in the assembly. Because if you say, all right, you can pray or prophesy with this covering on, and now in the assembly, you aren't to be praying and prophesying, you've got a problem. So if you limit it to the assembly, then you've got to do big gymnastics in chapter 14 to get out of your bind. So therefore, it cannot be limited just to the assembly. Here's another one that's related to this. The veiling needs to be worn only when praying with or prophesying to other people. I personally feel like that it should be worn at other times as well. And here are the reasons why. The reasons that Paul gives in support of the veiling are reasons that are continuously applicable. The constitution of the Godhead, the headship order established by God would refer to both public and private things. You know, a man is to submit to Christ in both public and private, and a woman to the man in private as well as public. The absence of a veiling calls for a shaved head. That's a continual demeanor. It's not just something that starts and stops during prayer. And with that regard, long hair is a continual glory, and it's not dependent on whether a woman is in a worship service or not, or whether she's ministering in the presence of others. I mean, your hair cannot be taken off and taken on several times a day. And so I think the suggestion would be, since there's a covering on the head also, that it would be the same kind of thing, that it should always be present. Also, the relationship of man and woman in terms of creation and purpose and glory, those purposes and glory and relationships do not start and cease just in the presence of other people. The subordination of woman is not something that's just intermittent. And the angelic issue, whatever that means, the angels don't go off to some other universe when a woman stops praying. I would also say that the verse that talks about the impropriety of a woman praying to God uncovered would give the flavor of something that is intrinsically rooted in the relationship of God and woman, not whether that particular episode was in public or not. And I'm using the word public to mean in the presence of other people, not saying it has to be a public meeting. I believe that the veiling should be worn as a practice, because that will enable you to always be ready for any ministry of prayer and exhortation. If you just wear the veiling just for prayer and prophecy, you know, sometimes people approach the passage this way, and they'll say, well, it just says for prayer and prophecy, that's the focus of the passage, so all these things are just related to prayer and prophecy, so that's all we need to wear it for. Well, first of all, why do you approach Scripture that way, as if you hate to do something any more than you would absolutely have to? But secondly, if you do it that way, it will inevitably bring you to a place where you do one of two things. Either you will do ministry while uncovered and therefore dishonor your head. Or you'll just say, well, I don't have my veiling, so I don't want to pray or prophesy and dishonor my head. You're going to do one or the other. In other words, if you just have an intermittent practice where whenever you go to pray or prophesy in the presence of some other person, you get that veiling out and put it on, I'll guarantee you, you're going to get in situations where you will violate this in one way or the other. You know, it is just foolish to put yourself in that position. Someone might make this argument. Well, our culture does not understand the veiling as a symbol of submission. Our culture does not understand the meaning and the significance of the baptism or the Lord's Supper either. So what do you have to do? You have to teach it. And the pagan culture in Africa or Asia or South America doesn't understand a whole bunch of doctrines. And the pagan culture in America doesn't understand it either. And in fact, many of the churches people come out of don't understand it, and the people don't understand it. It is time. Lots of these things really get taught. Besides, so what if our culture doesn't understand the significance of the veiling? Its significance can easily be stated in a sentence or two. And when you do state it, it actually makes feminists angry. There have been times when my wife has been asked by someone when we're in town or something, well, excuse me, what is that on your head? And when she explains what it is and how she is in submission to God's order of things, God, Christ, man, woman, and she's in harmony with that, oh, sometimes it'll make a person angry. In fact, I remember hearing a story of how a pastor told a woman not to say anything about her conviction regarding the veiling because it might interfere with other people's freedom. So she just began to get a conviction regarding the veiling. She began to wear the veiling at that church. And then later, all of a sudden, the pastor's wife burst out at her, "I wish you'd quit calling me a sinner." You know what? She hadn't said a word. Now, what's going on there? Obedience to God is one of the ways the Holy Spirit uses to rebuke those who are not obeying God. I mean, if everybody in the church ignores a certain passage, everybody feels comfortable ignoring it. In walks someone who's obeying it. It is a loud, nonverbal rebuke of obvious disobedience. I think that's one of the reasons why the modern evangelical community hates the veiling so much. I remember speaking to a lady who was living in Chicago, and she felt convicted to wear the veiling. You can imagine there are not many people in Chicago wearing veilings. But she didn't see it practiced anywhere. And she was afraid to do it because she was afraid people would view her as being cultish. And she loved to give testimony for Jesus. And she was afraid that it would hinder her testimony for Jesus if she had this thing on her hand. But finally she got to the point where she said, "Lord, that is your problem. Out of obedience to you, I'm going to just wear this thing." You know what she found out? She said she suddenly had more opportunities to witness than ever before. People would come out of the blue and ask her spiritual questions. You know, somehow, there's somehow some kind of awareness that this has some kind of religious significance. So, we need to take God for what He says, even if we don't understand it. Even if we don't agree with it. That ever happened to you? Even if we don't like it. But you know what? When you do it anyway, you get a new glory in your experience with God. Someone else is going to say, "Well, the lack of a head covering doesn't give any message in our culture." That may be. But I'll tell you something. The presence of a head covering does. I mean, often obedient ladies are asked what it means, and frequently there's a reaction of disapproval when they hear the principle. You see how you're getting right to the root of the thing. And this is not because some church told you to do it. It's just right here in the passage. If you read it, you can say, "Look, I do this because God said so. It's to help people keep their roles straight. And our society is way out of joint according to God's standards regarding men's roles and women's roles, and I'm in agreement with what God has to say, and this piece on my head is to remind me and everyone who sees me of that fact. Well, what if a wife realizes she has not been in submission to her husband? Shouldn't she take her veiling off? Because wouldn't that be a mockery to be wearing a veiling and not being obedient? The answer is no. Disobedience in one area is not solved by adding an additional disobedience in another area. I mean, you continue obeying the veiling issue and you repent of your sin and obey a guarding submission. I mean, it's sort of like the notion some parents have. Their child disobeys and the parent gets angry. And the parent thinks, I can't discipline my child because I got angry. That's false. Repent of your anger. Ask your child forgiveness and still discipline him for what he disobeyed. Those are two separate issues. You have to deal with both issues, not with neither. It's amazing how people love to do things like that. Something comes up, something is faulty. Well, if this is faulty, let's throw this away. It's foolishness. What if a husband forbids his wife to wear the veiling? Wouldn't it be better not to wear it because she would be making a mockery of submission to her husband? Remember that the foundational verse in this entire passage is the submission to the divine order. Christ is subject to the Father. Every man is subject to Christ. Woman is subject to man. Any husband who forbids his wife obedience has departed from that order, and he has no authority whatsoever in that matter. None. Not one iota. Otherwise, you're back to the Nuremberg trials. Now, there's a heresy widely afloat in our circles that says if a man tells his wife to do something that's wrong, she should obey, and God will hold him accountable, not her. That is false. That is wicked. It's heresy. The scriptures are abundantly clear. We are to never obey any earthly authority if it contradicts God's authority. Never. You see, nothing is gained by a woman joining her husband in disobedience. Scripture says we must obey God rather than men. And clearly, if that passage is going to apply everywhere else, it needs to apply here too. If a wife says, okay, I can disobey God here because my husband said so, then there's no stopping disobeying somewhere else because my husband said so. Somebody might quote, well, but it says, like the church obeys Christ, let the wife obey her husband in everything. Exactly right. How does the church obey Christ? Christ gives every command in perfect harmony with the Father. Christ never gives a command that's not in harmony with the Father. So if a human man, if a man gives a command not in harmony with the Father, he is out of that authority structure on that point. It's not saying he's out of it at every point, but he's out of it on that one, and he has no authority on that whatsoever. Now, clearly, a wife has to handle this carefully. I think the first thing, if her husband says, I don't want you to wear the veiling, she better check her own life and see if she's been obedient and submissive and godly in all the other areas that are involved in terms of being a wife and mother. I mean, if she's been bellyaching about the color of the drapes, she should work on those areas first. In other words, if you have given your husband the wrong notions about your operation in this headship order, and you're going to make some changes in your life, change the spiritual part first so you can see the value of this other part. And then appeal to him, give him time to think about it, and pray that God would change his mind. Now you can ask this question. Does all this matter? Is the veiling just a small thing? Well, in the scriptures, there are many cases where small things mattered. Uzzah touched that ark. He was going to keep the ark from falling off, you know. When the ox stumbled, God struck him dead. Saul went out on a campaign against the Amalekites. And, you know, he saved some of the best cattle and he saved Agag. It cost him his kingdom. The unnamed prophet who went and prophesied against Jeroboam at the golden calf, God said, don't you eat or drink anything there. go back a different way. And he did everything so wonderfully. And then on the way back, a prophet of God lied to him and said, an angel of God came and told him to come back. So he went back and ate with him. And then the word came to that prophet and said, you're going to not reach the graves of your fathers. Now you might say, that seemed too harsh. You know what? God was making a gigantic point. I expect you to obey me regardless of what any prophet or leader or anybody else has to say. You don't just say, well, he said so. I'll just do that and God will hold him to account. Who did God hold to account here? The man who disobeyed. He didn't have the lion kill the old prophet that lied. Now, obviously, that isn't justifying lying. But it's still clear that disobedience cannot be vindicated by saying an authority told me so. You know what? Many people are lying about 1 Corinthians 11 today. They're just lying, and there's plenty of people who want to believe those lies. Moses struck the rock, you remember? He was supposed to strike it once. Then the next time, God said, speak to the rock. And he struck it in anger. And God said, because you did this, you can't go into the promised land. Now that seems pretty harsh. That seems pretty severe. You know, Moses couldn't enter because of dishonoring God in relation to a physical thing. Amazing. That shows that God thinks it's pretty important. If you refuse to obey God, you are not honoring Him, plain and simple. In fact, it's very interesting, the key verse, Numbers 20, verse 12, God is speaking to Moses about this, and He says, because you do not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel. How about Adam and Eve in the garden? In itself, eating fruit is not a sinful issue. It's not a spiritual issue. It is not wrong to have knowledge of good and evil. It is just wrong to have knowledge of good and evil apart from God's terms of having that knowledge. God has knowledge of good and evil. You see, this tree was a good mechanism to enable man to grow in spiritual maturity. I like to ask people sometimes, what about the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Was that good or was that bad? And a lot of people don't, they sort of think it's bad. That's false. The answer is crystal clear. That tree was good. It was very good. Why? God put something in the garden to help man grow in spiritual maturity that had minimal losses. I mean, think about it. Everything else was perfectly wonderful. This fellow had a perfect wife. That's quite something. And she had a perfect husband. That's probably even more something. And what they have to do? Exercise will and faith. I will obey God even if I don't understand why. Oh. That was a great blessing to enable man to move to a new level of spiritual growth. Imagine saying this. Well, if I eat this fruit and keep my attitude right toward God, everything will be okay. That wouldn't change anything. How important is this? Those who turn away from the truth will be turned aside to fables. If you like to you can turn to 2 Timothy 4:4. And I'll read the context, verses 1 to 3. I charge you therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who will judge the living and the dead at his appearing in his kingdom. In other words, in relation to eternity, and in light of Jesus as coming judge, there's an emphasis on preaching and doctrine. Preach the word, be it ready in season and out of season, convince, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and teaching. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth, and be turned aside to fables. Now notice, what's this man supposed to do? He's supposed to preach the word, not his own opinions. And he's supposed to look for opportunities in season and out of season. And don't be intimidated by those who disagree. Be able to rebuke and exhort and have discussions. You know, when you have discussions with someone who disagrees with you, it might reveal the weak reasons you've got. Well, then you can fix them. That's nice. And notice, with long-suffering. Well, what if he doesn't see it right away? It might take some time. I remember I was teaching on a certain subject about the cross, and there was some opposition at this place. And then years later, I was in New York City, and someone came to me and they said, "Ray, I have got to talk to you." He said, "Remember back at that place when you were teaching on that subject and I opposed you?" Actually, I'd forgotten it. He said, "I agree with you now." You know, there are times that a person opposes you, but the word is powerful and it sinks there in their mind and they think about it and it takes some years, but they eventually change. You know, this pattern now is easily observable. Watch this. Verse 4. They will turn their ears away from the truth. That's the active part. And then something begins to act on them. And they will be turned aside to fables. This is a pattern that's easily observable. First is active, turning away from the truth. And then the person is acted upon. Now, just because there are many women who wear veilings, who do not live meek and submissive lives, doesn't mean you should disobey another one of God's commands. In fact, I think you'll find that discarding of the veiling almost inevitably produces a pattern of other deficiencies that follow. Insubordination, improper role in the assembly, disobedience in other areas regarding, like, focus on the home. Almost a year ago, a young lady from New York City brought two of her Chinese friends to visit us on her way to Florida. And their comment was, "In all the Mennonite homes that we've been to, the mother is so calm and the children are so orderly. Why is that?" I thought that was an interesting testimony. In other words, there is something going on here. Now, obviously, the veiling passage is not the most important passage in the Bible. I mean, in itself, it doesn't encapsulate the meaning of the gospel. But since the passage is founded in verse 3, it is a very important passage. Well, why don't we pause right there? We'll give you time for questions.